Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for the Sasquatch Experience with your hosts, Sean Porker and Henry May, live on Blog Talk Radio. The show starts now.
Well, good evening, everyone. It's that time of the week again for the Sasquatch Experience. I'm your host, Sean Forker, alongside Henry May, joined tonight by James Baker and the very beautiful Melissa Hovey. How are you doing tonight, everybody?
Oh, great. Great, Sean. Great.
Doing good.
Been looking forward to this.
Me too. Melissa, thanks for joining us tonight. James Baker's there off and off far in the distance. But he's still with us, going to field his questions to us as we go along here. Henry, what do you got for us in terms of news this week?
Well, not a whole lot as far as news. I guess, what has been going on? Just not a whole lot going on, you know. There's a story about the ivory-billed woodpecker, which is being sought in Texas. This is an interesting news item. Now scientists create a sheep that's 15% human.
Wow. That is interesting.
Like Dolly Madison.
15% human. Wow. Now going back to the ivory-billed woodpecker, Henry, I was reading somewhere that a scientist believes that what was ever photographed or caught on film was not an ivory-billed woodpecker. Do you remember seeing that?
Yeah, some of them think it's what they call a pileated woodpecker, which is very similar. It's also a large woodpecker, much like the ivory-billed. Apparently the ivory-billed has a very distinctive, wing pattern. And that's how they were able to determine that it was an ivory-billed.
Okay, so that's how they were able to tell it was, because of the wing pattern. So this other gentleman, whoever they may be, is saying that they've misidentified it.
Well, they're saying that they've misidentified it as an ivory-billed, but, you know, some of the skeptical scientists think it's a pileated woodpecker. So, you know, there you go.
Well, it's still important in terms of, you know, in terms of discovery and just to show, you know, that what could be one man's huge find is another man's, chance to prove someone else wrong. It's kind of funny because now there's even that certain percentage of doubt that it could even be an ivory-billed woodpecker.
Yeah, right.
And that's right in front of them.
Yeah,
weird.
I mean, people have been seeing this thing, and they've seen it. Now they're looking for it in Texas. They've seen it in Arkansas. They've seen it in the panhandle of Florida. These people are seeing something, you know.
That's very interesting. I every once in a while, folks, we like to talk about our other fellow cryptids. So that's a little bit, to go off on a tangent from the Sasquatch every once in a while.
Right.
But that is a little bit of interesting news, that and the 15% human sheep.
Yeah.
Yanni,
well, Melissa,
those sheep
we're all
alone.
Glad to have you here, hon. How are you?
I'm doing good.
That's good. Matter of fact, let's see.
Oh, yes. Henry and Melissa, tomorrow collectively is your birthday.
Yep. And happy birthday to you, Melissa.
Yeah, happy birthday to you too, Henry.
You guys are both turning 18 again, I see. So.
Yeah.
How's it feel to be so young?
Feels great to me. Oh, we have a comment from the chat room. Tom Sheehan says, how about the clouded leopard? You know, I'm not familiar with that. I'm not too familiar with that, but...
Give Henry a week, and he'll be up to date. You know, we don't want to be accused of being horrible researchers again, so...
Right.
We'll wait a little bit to tackle that one, folks. But thank you for bringing that to our attention, Tom. Good old Hollywood. Melissa, tell us a little bit about your research in Texas. I know recently you've been out in the field on a few expeditions, and just tell us a little bit about your expeditions, but more so your research in Texas.
Well, actually, I haven't been on an expedition since last year, but when I go out in Texas on expeditions, you know, groups of two or more, it's always in conjunction with the TBRC, Texas Bigfoot Research, and they've now changed their name. So they're now known as the Texas Bigfoot Research Conservancy.
You changed that one little word, and it throws me off completely. I tell you what.
I know. Yeah, I keep messing up, too. So don't feel bad. But so when I go out with them, I'm really kind of reluctant to actually discuss what I do in the field because they have excellent spokespeople, one being Craig Wilheater. He's a great man, and I'm more than happy to let him talk for the group. And Daryl Collier, and he's another great guy. He does the majority of the planning for the larger expeditions. And but recently here, they just posted about the January 2006 expedition into the Big Thicket. That was my first full expedition, and it was a large group of people, and we were out there for approximately, I believe it was 5 or 6 days. And I'll tell you, it was a week. It was a tough week. So.
Yeah, from what I read, you weren't drinking enough water, which I can't stress the importance enough to everybody out there who does go into the field to make sure you're plenty hydrated.
Right, right. And, you know, since all of that, I learned that very quickly. You know, being from the north, you're just not subject to the type of, the kind of heat and humidity that you have down here. So if you're not pushing fluids out there, I mean, you're not doing yourself any favors. So always do that.
And yeah, even more so down south where it is a lot hotter.
Right.
It's even enough up here during the daytime when you're out hiking up in Pennsylvania and it's 100 degrees outside with 100% humidity. And I'm not exactly as they say, in the best of shape. So
wow.
That doesn't help either, going out there in the forest looking for Bigfoot and sweating Crisco.
Well, I think we all could be doing a little bit better in that respect. But, I mean, down here, I mean, I probably, when I went on this expedition, I mean, I would consider myself in good shape. But I'm telling you, during the daytime, even in January in the state of Texas, even in that time of the year, I mean, during the day it's hot, and you sweat, but then at night it gets so cold, you know. I mean, you can actually see your breath in front of your face, and I think a lot of it is just, you know, the extremes is what gets to you physically. So
the transition between hot and cold.
Right, right. Okay. And that's
that was the way it was in Chicago. I hated that.
Yeah. So I mean, it's something that the researchers here really have to deal with, and I mean, I give them all kinds of credit because it's not easy. But it's something that we have to learn to deal with. So, and I learned that lesson the hard way. So,
well, not just the extreme weather, but you guys have more so of a variety of wildlife than we do. Some of that very dangerous.
Yeah.
I have to watch out for snakes. You guys have all kinds of things to watch out for. So, Sean Forker might be postponing his trip to Texas to research Bigfoot for a few more years.
Yeah, I mean, when I first moved down here, I mean, I knew that, you know, this was the South, and I realized that they had snakes and things like that, but I guess the reality of it really didn't hit until I started going out into the field with these people. And, you know, you start hearing things like, well, you definitely need to buy snake boots.
Oh, yes.
You know, things like this. Bear spray. You know, and then you start thinking about it, and you're going, well, wait a minute. But, you know, I mean, after being out there a couple of times, you know, you start to know what to do and what not to do, you know, and the fear kind of starts to subside, and, you know, you just do what you're there to do. You know, you just know not to walk up to the side of a lake or a river and, you know, hang over the edge. You know, it's just something that you don't do. So.
I'm afraid of possums. I don't like them very much.
Oh, I don't like the armadillos.
Yeah, they scare the crap out of me, possums.
Oh. We have possums around here. We have this one little white-faced possum. He is so funny. He's been around here since he was little, you know. And he'll get in the trash can, you know. My mom will see him in there. She'll chase him out of there, and he'll run a little bit, look back, run a little bit, look back.
Now you know Henry's from Mississippi when he has a pet possum hanging around.
Right.
Yeah. And raccoons. So we got raccoons, too.
They're like rats the size of small dogs.
Back to Melissa's story here, guys. So you're out on expedition. Come across anything interesting?
Well, being in an organization the size of the TBRC, you have the opportunity to do things that you wouldn't normally do if you were just out there with somebody, you know, with just like a group of two or three researchers. With the TBRC, we actually can organize day operations and night. Basically, that means we have researchers in the field in the middle of the night, and then during the day, we have day teams that go out and look for evidence of things that could have possibly happened the night before, like tracks or anything like that. And or, you know, the day teams will go and scout out a new potential area to research for the night before or the night to come. So, I mean, that's always pretty interesting. The first night I arrived down there, I actually slept out on a sandbar, and that was interesting for me because I'm, you know, a lot of people like to pick on me about the fact that I'm such a city girl. But I stayed out on a sandbar all night, and it got cold. But as far as interesting, that's something that's really hard for me to say because you just, you know, I don't know what to compare interesting to at this point. I try to stay very objective about what I hear or see or anything out in the field. Unless I was to actually walk up on one of these animals. You know, I really try to stay as objective as I possibly can. Now, if I'm walking through the field one day and I actually bump into one, things will probably change. But I can say that the Saturday morning that we were there in the field that morning, I was on a day team with a couple other researchers, and I came across something, and to this day I still don't have a good explanation for what it is. And, I mean, I don't know. We tried for well over an hour to push out whatever it was into the open, into a clearing, so that one of us could get a visual. And we just were not able to do it. And whatever it was, which is kind of would go out further into the brush, which was really thick. And it was really thick, dense brush in this area. But then as soon as we would go back, whatever it was would circle back and come back to where we all started. And then we would just start this all over again. So I don't know what that could have been, but I'm sure there's probably a logical explanation for it. I just don't know what it is yet. So, but I'm looking for people who might have ideas. So,
and that's very similar to the experience I had. I don't know what made it or what caused the experience I had. And it's always healthy to keep that certain amount of objectivity and skepticism because you don't want to make assumptions.
Right.
Because then in the end, you're the one that looks horrible over it.
Well, when you're out there in the field, you're not out there to make assumptions. You're out there to get evidence, and evidence is proof of what you're seeing or not. If you jump to conclusions, then you're really negating the whole process. You're there to get evidence, period. And that's the way I approach it.
So what do you say to those that are out there and they believe beyond a shadow of a doubt what they've seen, yet they have no evidence to back it up, no supporting and, you know, anything corroborative to their story? You know, what do you say to them? Go out and try to collect better evidence, or especially to the people that have made up their mind that they're 100% positive what they've seen?
Well, I think it all depends. I mean, I have two different standards. You know, I mean, and you've got to in this. There's the witnesses that are not involved in Bigfoot research. These are just your normal, average, everyday person who's just doing what they do.
Now, let's be clear one thing for the audience. She says she has two sets of standards. not meaning she has double standards.
Right, right. Thank you.
Okay.
I mean, these are just the witnesses that report via the website or they dial an 800 number. These are just people, and if they're good witnesses, they're just reporting something that they've seen and they don't understand what it was. And they're hoping somebody can help them figure that out. But then when you have researchers out there who are out there specifically to try to either prove or disprove this animal's existence, I think the bar is a little higher for the standard of evidence that they bring in. I mean, I'm less likely to, you know, just jump right behind a researcher who says, oh, my gosh, I heard the animal. I heard it made wood knocks. I did. I was there, and, oh, my goodness, I couldn't believe it. Well, then you ask them, do you have it on video? Do you have any audio recordings of it?
Not to mention the fact that we still don't have any evidence that wood knocks are conclusive.
Right.
You know, are conclusive proof that they are made exclusively by Sasquatch. We don't know that.
Right. So, but, I mean, I think that the standard of proof has to be higher for the researcher because that's the person who's supposed to be out there doing the work.
But don't you think one thing that would be more beneficial to us as researchers is having that standardized, you know, methodology, standardized, you know, what's accepted as evidence?
Right. I do.
And we don't have that yet.
But then the problem also becomes at that point, and I totally agree with that way of thinking. I do think that certain things in this need to be standardized. But then you come across the issue of how do you get researchers to go along with this? Because
exactly.
You have to remember, researchers out there, I'd say 90 to 95% of them are independent. And you can't force people to do something.
And then there's also the part of that that says, hey, wait a minute, because it's generally accepted doesn't mean that's the correct way to do things either.
Right. Exactly. So, I mean, how do you get people that are, you know, outwardly and very happy about the fact that they're independent, they're not taking marching orders from anyone, how do you get them to accept and then incorporate these standards into their research?
See, I don't think there's anything wrong with being independent, but I think there has to be some sort of standardized, you know, set of rules we follow, set of... I'm searching for the term here. I just don't have it at the moment verbally. You know, there has to be those standards set, a standard operating procedure, if you would.
Right.
You know, we have to have that.
Well, science has that. I mean, I don't think that when other scientists are out in the jungle searching for new animals, I don't think that they're just doing it, you know, and not keeping up with or not keeping track of what they're coming across. They're doing things that are methodical, and they're doing things to document every step of the process. And that's what we're going to need. I mean, especially for people like me who don't want to have to kill the animal in order to prove that it exists.
And I'm definitely with you on that. I'm a very big proponent of the no-kill philosophy, and I'm going to stay that way. I don't think we need to kill a creature to prove its existence.
But the only way to do that, though, then, because I don't think video is going to be the only thing that did it, but that
no.
will do it.
No, not at all.
And I don't think a footprint is going to be the only thing that does it. It's going to be how researchers actually compile and how they present the evidence that they have collected. It's going to come out to, okay, yes, I have a video of this animal, but at the same time, I have footprints of this animal. I have this. I have recordings. I have, you know, it's going to come down to how much evidence do you have to throw on the table all at the same time.
The quality of quantity of evidence is going to help us.
Right.
Which is what you're saying.
Right.
Well, I have this to say. You know, those who say that footprints are not physical evidence, well, Rene de Hinden put it so bluntly. He said, you know, people say the footprints are not physical evidence. He said, how would you like it if I hit you over the head with one of those footprints plaster casts? Don't you think that would be physical?
Well, but the point is it is physical evidence, but it's secondary, meaning that we did not see it. We did not physically see something make that footprint.
Right.
That's right.
I mean, it's all nice and dandy to want to try to make that physical evidence, but unless you saw the Sasquatch stick his foot in the mud, you know, we have no proof what made it. I mean, look at, you know, all these years later, and Ray Wallace still makes all the fake Bigfoot prints in America, you know what I mean? And the guy's been dead now.
Right.
Yeah. Well, the only evidence we have, the only time that a Sasquatch has been seen making tracks for sure was actually filmed. And, of course, that was the Patterson Gimlin movie.
And then there's still those that debate that that's actually, you know, a man in a suit. So
well,
that's going to be the problem with video, too, unless it's high quality and it's shot from multiple angles. And, you know, we're asking for the impossible in terms of video evidence, but that's what it's going to take.
Right. Well, you know, here within the last few weeks, a couple of guys that we both know, Billy Willard and Tom Lancaster, they actually posted on their website how they step-by-step, methodically put down on paper the graph, and, I mean, you can't even imagine how great that this is.
And that's exactly what needs to be done.
Right. They took an entire scene, and they broke it down, and they put it on paper, and you can look at this and see the exact alleged pathway that this, you know, unknown animal took. And, I mean, I thought that was phenomenal. And more researchers should pay attention, because it's going to be things like this, you know, how people put it down on paper and how you're documenting your evidence that's going to turn the head of science.
Now, I've actually been out in the field with Billy Willard, and I tell you what, if I ever go out in the field with anybody again, I'd like it to be Billy Willard, because I learned quite a bit from him that night we were out. And he's just a fun person to go out with, but he's always in tune of
right.
what's going on around him.
Yep.
Always.
Both him and Tom. Great.
And well, I haven't had the privilege of going out with Tom yet. I did speak to Tom on the phone one night we were out in the field. But Billy and Tom know their stuff.
Yeah,
and
they do.
They're really...
Right.
I
and
mean,
right
not, now, I'd consider
right.
them some of the top researchers in America. I really would.
Right.
But,
and,
you know,
I mean, and regardless of whether or not you think, after looking at this information, whether or not you think what they actually outlined and graphed is actual Bigfoot movement, whether or not you think that is all secondary, in my opinion, the fact is these guys actually put to paper the way these different scenes, I think, in my opinion, should be cataloged. And they set it down. I mean, and I looked at that and I thought, you know, that's some damn good work.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to refer back to something Sean said earlier, referring to if we can get good video footage. Well, you know, some researchers, what they want to do is, you know, they say that if you can get footage of a Sasquatch doing something which would be physically impossible for a man to do, you know, that video footage would go a long way towards perhaps proving, you know, that the Sasquatch exists.
Well, that's fine, but unfortunately, to this date, I have not heard Sasquatch do anything that a man cannot do, and that's talking from a strictly flesh and blood aspect.
Well, I think at this point, I think I'd just be happy to see clear footage of a Sasquatch. I mean, I'm
with you there.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice to say those kinds of things, but, you know, I mean, at this point, we just have to hope and pray that we get the best possible footage that we can. I mean, I don't know, even if the best possible footage is ever going to be enough. But, I mean, yeah, it would be nice to be able to get on film a Sasquatch doing something that a normal man couldn't do. But, I mean, realistically, I'll just take it on film, period.
Quality film, you know?
Right.
and there's so much technology out there today that shouldn't be, you know, that shouldn't be a problem, yet it continually is. One thing I was always asked by Rob McConnell is, with so many digital, you know, cameras and digital equipment and cell phones, why isn't there, you know, the definitive picture of Sasquatch? And the problem is when you're, and I'm just going to go off on a tangent for a second, and a technological aspect, when you look at a cellular phone camera or video camera, you're looking at, a 1.3 megapixel camera.
Right.
You're not looking at a very high-quality camera that can do, you know, anything more than just take a low-res picture. And... So, first of all, that's a moot point, because it just, you're not going to get that kind of picture from a cellular phone. The other thing is, these creatures, and this is just speculative only, I think they're able to recognize metallic objects, whether they be guns, knives, video cameras. The point is, when you point something at a creature, and you can do this experiment with deer or other wildlife, when you pull something out at them that they're not expecting and try to take even a picture of them, they're not going to appreciate it too much, and they're going to try to run from it. They're not going to stick around.
Yeah, it's kind of like when I try to take a picture of my dog. She won't stay in one spot for no apparent reason. If I stand there 5 seconds later, she'll sit there and look at me like she knows, but the second I pull that camera out, she bolts, you know.
It's just, you know, and I think part of the reason is that is, you know, all electronics emit some kind of frequency. And animals, you know, just have that natural ability to sense those things that we wouldn't necessarily pick up on. And that's just my theory on that. Take it what it's worth, my 2 cents, but that's what I believe.
Well, yeah, I've heard all kinds of theories as to why we're not able to get this animal on film. And I just think, honestly, it's just the cameras are not in the right place at the right time. I don't think it's some big, you know, mystery about how an animal can sense the camera. I really don't believe that. I think that, like, in situations like when you have an animal in your home, like, you know, the gentleman that was just saying, I think that it's because probably the dog had been flashed before in the eyes, and the dog will remember that. So, I mean, it's like you've just trained your dog to stay away from you when you have a camera. So I think that it's things like that.
But at the same time, if we're not having cameras in the right place at the right time, why are we putting up game cams?
Well, hopefully they'll be in the right place finally for once at the right time.
And why haven't they yielded results? I mean, we can get bears on game cams and deer and other wildlife, but at the same time, we're also dealing with a creature that may have some form of intelligence.
But it also could be, though, too, that we're getting deer and bear on game cams because there's so many more of those than the possibility of a Sasquatch walking in front of a game cam. I mean, I would probably guess the numbers are probably nowhere near as high as what some people think.
Definitely not. But just for the sake of, you know, continuing this conversation, if we put these cameras out for extended periods of time in areas where they have a large amount of a Sasquatch activity. Dance Hall, if you're familiar with Tom Powell's book, The Locals. One thing I can say is that there are some interesting pictures of shadows or shadowy images, but nothing that can be deemed conclusive. And those pictures were on the BFR website if you went on his book, and I'll post that link on the website after the show on the blog, and you can see what I'm talking about if it's still up. But it was pretty interesting, and that was an ongoing study. But it still yielded no conclusive results.
Right. But, I mean, it also could boil down to shutter speed. It, you know, and there's so many other variables that work into that. I mean, I'm just not ready to say that. I mean, I'm not saying that this is not a smart animal. It very well could be. I don't know. But at the same point, I'm just not at a point where I'm ready to say that this animal is so smart it can figure out what a game cam is.
I don't think it's smart enough to be able to recognize what an object is and to avoid its detection. I think it is smart enough to realize that when a human being pulls something out that is not recognizable to them, or maybe something that they do recognize from experience, they know that it's something that they don't want to be involved with. Do you know what I mean? It's not exactly intelligence more so than instinct.
Yeah, well, if they pointed at them, you know, they're going to think, oh, my God, that's a gun, or, you know.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, you're not going to take a camera after a Bigfoot and take pictures of it, you know, hold it out to you and take a picture to the side.
Right.
Right.
You've got, like, 5 seconds to take the picture of the lifetime.
but then you're also going against the fact that there's researchers out there who believe that this animal is attracted by shiny objects. So, I mean, it's half a dozen of one, and, you know, so, I mean, it's really difficult to say for sure, but I mean, it would be nice to at least just get a picture of it, period.
Oh, it would be wonderful to have that picture, but do I think we're going to get it?
No.
No. Unfortunately, I think if anything's going to happen, and this is a very grim approach, I think that perhaps that someone from the pro-kill proponent might get one, or hopefully what I hope happens, and folks, don't take this the wrong way, but I hope one day that a logging truck smacks into one.
Well, I'd rather see that happen than somebody take one out with a shotgun.
Me too.
Sure.
Yeah.
So.
I was going to say something. Oh, about... Oh, shoot. I forgot. It'll come to me in a minute. It has something to do... Oh, now I remember. Apparently, some researchers have speculated that sometimes these creatures can smell metal, like on a gun or a camera, and that's why, you know, they're able to avoid being seen so much. You know, if they know you've got metal, if they can smell that metal, then they'll avoid you. Hello?
But then there's also that theory that we were talking about a few weeks ago about the Sasquatch and attracted to, you know, I'm talking about Henry the Trailers or whatever, shiny metallic objects.
Yeah, that was last week.
That was last week.
The ever-controversial Lauren Coleman.
Well, and you know, he has his rights to his theories as everyone else does. But the one thing to understand is that we're talking theory. And the one thing, Melissa, that I love about you the most is that you're more science. You're more science than theory. And, you know, to take a step back.
Theory helps us come up with ideas to help push this forward in this research. But it's going to be the technology and the science that's going to prove it to the world.
Exactly. But in order to come up with these hypotheses, we have to theorize.
Right.
And, you know, it's all a very important part of the scientific process.
Right. And I completely agree with that.
I mean, if we're not going to come up with the ideas, we're just not going to be able to, you know, if we're not coming up with more ideas, then we're just not very good researchers.
Right. That has to be a critical part of your research, coming up with ideas. What's next? You know, what are you going to do next? Move forward. What did you do this last time that you thought maybe could have had a little bit of success? What are you going to do the next time to hopefully push it more forward? So that's, I mean, I love discussing theories and ideas, but I'm hoping that when people discuss theories that it's working towards something.
But the one thing I like about this conversation we're having tonight, that the theories we have are in the realm of possibility.
Right.
I mean, these theories that we're discussing aren't far out. They're, you know, they're right, you know, and to some this, you know, isn't what they like to hear, but they stay within the flesh and blood aspect and realm.
Well,
of what we consider them to be, you know, realistically.
I'm not going to have unrealistic conversations about an animal that I don't even know exists.
Exactly. I mean, it's bad enough that we talk, you know, that everything we're talking about right now, even the existence of this creature, is pure speculation. I mean, we do have what we consider evidence. Obviously, science doesn't think it's enough. And actually... I agree. We don't have enough evidence. What do you think about that, Melissa? Do we have enough?
No, we don't. And I totally agree with that way of thinking. And we're not going to have enough if researchers don't put serious thought into what they're doing. I mean, it's serious business what we're doing out there. And I mean, I can't, when I talk to other researchers, I mean, I don't stress enough how important it is to gather and maintain and preserve evidence properly. It is extremely important, especially if you think that you have the best track that you've casted in your lifetime. It is extremely important how you preserve that and maintain it. And when you come upon these different areas in your research areas, how you catalog everything that you see is so important, because nobody's going to care if you just say, this happened because I said it happened. That's not going to impress anyone. It's going to be what you have on paper and what you can show me that's going to turn the head of somebody that you want to listen. So,
in terms of that evidence that we have that we neither one of us don't deem to be the best evidence, but within that realm of possible evidence we have, what do you consider to be the best piece of it? Starting to feel like James Lipton, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, if I had to pick and choose what I think is the best potential evidence that we have, I would have to say that it's the Skookum cast and quite possibly different tracks that are have been preserved. That, in my opinion, is something that we can work on. And we have an idea, basically, based on these tracks that have been casted, at least of what the foot may look like if this animal is really out there.
The one thing I really think is awesome that Dr. Meldrum and Jimmy Chilcutt, you know, Dr. Chilcutt, after examining, you know, the collection of Jeff Meldrum's footprints, you know, and the appearance of the friction ridges, the dermal ridges, and now we have that typeset. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
We have that, you know, starting to recognize these things. And Cass, however, now finding out that that's also not entirely infallible.
Well, I guess it all depends.
I mean, you have done some really good work to prove that, and I could be wrong, to try to dispel the friction ridge. I'm searching for the terminology again because I just can't word it correctly. Your experiments with foot castings.
Right.
And you put a lot of hard work into that. So why don't you go, instead of me trying to steal your thunder, why don't you go into that a little bit?
Well, I'm not trying to prove anybody wrong. And that's been the biggest misconception about my work. I'm not trying to prove anyone wrong. My whole point in this work that I'm doing is to help researchers understand what they need to be looking for in these tracks and how to properly cast when they actually come across a track that they think is worthy of preserving. That's what my goal is. And if researchers could, you know, understand that if this animal does, if these tracks do belong to this animal, then these are something that we need to know how to preserve. And, I mean, I can't stress that enough. But in order to do that, researchers need to understand how to properly mix the casting agents, how to properly put it into that track, and then what to do with it later. And there are so many different variables that go into casting that I don't even think a lot of researchers really thought about, because I never even thought about it. And I've worked with plaster of Paris and for years, and I just never even knew that some of these things that I've come across could actually create issues within your own casting. So, but I think that this is important for researchers to understand. I mean, otherwise, don't waste your money. I mean, this stuff is not cheap. Hydrocal is not cheap, and all the things that go into it. If you're not going to do it properly, I don't even know why people would want to waste their money.
And there, once again, it goes into that we need that standard operating procedure in research. But as you said, as in with so many other things, there's that variable. You know, there's those variables that sometimes, you know, make the, you know, what would be the standard operating procedures not exactly work, such as soil temperature, moisture levels.
Right.
You know, all those factors that have to be taken into consideration when you make a cast.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And a lot of people don't think that. A lot of people think we just whip up the Bisquick and pour it in the track.
Right.
You know, for lack of a better term, and that's just not how it happens. There's a lot to go into it.
Right. Well, you know, and that was a really big surprise for me, actually, was finding out that temperature does play an important role. And for anybody to discount that, well, they're just flat out wrong. Temperature of the water and temperature of the soil, all of those things can create issues within your own plastic, your own casting. And
you almost have to look at it kind of like baking.
Right.
You really do. There's a science to baking. Sorry to interrupt you there.
No, that's okay. But, no, you're right. And, I mean, it's really not that difficult. And I found that generally if you stay between, you know, within 5 degrees of air temperature, I mean, your casting should work out fine. But it's like, you know, when researchers go to the nearby lake or they go to the nearby stream, that water is not air temperature. You shouldn't be doing that. I mean, take along water, get it out of your tap, put it in an old milk jug or something, but let it sit out and get to air temperature. Because as long as you stay within a plus or minus of 5 degrees, you know, you should be fine. But it's when you introduce extremes into your casting, that's when I start seeing the biggest problem. But I still, to this day, I mean, I've got probably, I don't even know how many casts I have, but to this day, I still have not been able to duplicate the artifacts that have been discussed that look like dermal ridges. And, but I'm still working at it, still trying. But, I mean, it comes down to, I mean, it may just be something that only happens in one type of soil. So, I don't know.
Now, I'm reading here in the chat room, and right now they're talking about pheromone chips. Have you ever actually had the privilege of smelling a pheromone chip?
Oh, Lord have mercy. Yes, I did.
Eric Altman told me, my mentor, Eric Altman, who I got out in the field with last year on expedition, told me not to smell the pheromone chip. We got them from Dr. Bambanek, Dr. Juice, and, of course, me being the green, you know, I open up the jar, stick my face in, I swear to God, that thing burnt my nostrils. It was the worst thing I've ever smelled.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, it was awful.
Yeah.
So don't ever do that, folks. If you're listening, do not ever sniff a Sasquatch pheromone chip because you will regret it. I swear to God, I had that smell embedded in my nose for weeks at a time.
Yeah.
John, I'm a phone number out there, folks. Folks, if you're listening tonight, the number is 347-996-5814.
Call in with your questions for...
Call in.
Well, listen, I have to say this has been one. This is a great show we're having tonight. A lot of good, productive discussion. And
we've got a question from our good friend Bill Green from the chat room. Melissa, what's the best Texas Bigfoot encounters you investigated with the TBRC?
Actually, I have not had the privilege of actually going out and investigating, a one-on-one sighting with a witness yet. Unfortunately, my job and other issues have just kept me way too busy, and along with casting. You can add casting right up there. But I do know, I mean, there's been some reports that I've read on the website, and one in particular, I actually was able to meet that witness. And his sighting was, I thought, very credible. And, I mean, I'd like to have the opportunity to speak with him some more. But, I mean, he showed up at a meeting to talk about it. And, he to me sounded like somebody who saw something that he could not explain. His sighting involved two, one being male and one was female. And I really don't want to discuss specifics, but his sighting was one that I don't hear much of. So it was pretty amazing.
I just wanted to add that those of you who have been regular listeners on my show have heard about the encounter I had in the woods last year and the Chestnut Ridge in Pennsylvania. I don't know if I should say this or not, but the area where I had my encounter is having ongoing activity lately, and right now, today, we sent two researchers out to investigate it, what's going on out there. We got some pretty interesting stuff coming from Pennsylvania, so just keep your ears posted. Listen to the show for more details.
Wow. That's pretty awesome.
So yeah,
it kind of validates the encounter you had.
Well, it doesn't validate, because, like I said before, I never seen... I can't explain what made me feel the way I did that day. All I can do is theorize, but it does add a little bit, and I'll say this, it does add a little bit more validity in terms of possibility of what I encountered that day. All I know is that when I had that experience, I didn't want to go back, and I'm still very... I still have a lot of apprehension of going back, to be honest with you.
Oh, yeah.
It's an experience I had that I don't particularly like to remember. It's something that I've never felt so... I felt, for lack of a better term, once again, I felt violated. Like paralyzed and emotionally and mentally drained. It just drained me. I would never want to feel that way again. And Billy Willard, who, the investigator in Virginia, also had a similar experience to mine, and he'll tell you the same thing. He wouldn't care if he ever felt that way again. so it's not exactly a fun experience. But nonetheless, I'll get back up on the horse, and I plan on going back out there in a few weeks, yielding tonight's investigation results. So I'll keep you posted.
Melissa, I have a question for you.
Okay.
What is your opinion of the Lake Worth monster sightings of the late 1960s? I'm sure you've heard about them, and it's interesting. That only occurred that one summer, and I don't think there have been any sightings in that area since. I was just wondering what your opinion on that was.
Well, I really don't know that I have an opinion one way or the other. I mean, it was such an it was so long ago. You know, I basically have a rule where, I mean, if something happened within the last 6 months to a year, that's something that I'm extremely interested in. And when you start going back onto reports that are 25 years old, they're interesting. They add to the collection of reports and the corroboration of other witnesses. But, I mean, I really don't know. I've read about it, and, you know, I mean, people talk about it, but, I mean, I really don't have an opinion about it one way or the other. I don't with most reports, so, especially if I have never spoken to the person myself. That's something that I prefer to do before I decide one way or the other.
We do have a comment here from Anonymous, Melissa, and I'll address this, and then, of course, I'll let you address this as always. The comment being, let me go back up here and get it. Standardization is good, but I think some don't want their dream crushed, that comment. And it stood out for me for one reason. First of all, I think being a dreamer is all right, okay? But I don't think that when you're looking for an animal that may or may not exist and you're trying to apply scientific principle to it, I don't think there's any room for dreaming.
Right.
I think it's that you either, you know, are objective and collect the evidence, or you've already made up your mind, and the evidence really isn't that important. I think if somebody wants to believe in something so much that nothing they find is going to be able to change their mind anyhow.
Right. Well, frankly, and I mean no offense to this person, but I'm involved in this because I think the possibility is there for this animal to actually exist. Do I know it exists? No. But I'm not interested in dreams, personally. And if there's a researcher out there who's doing this strictly because they're wanting to dream big of what this will do to their life and how this will make them important and on and on and on, I really don't care if the dreams get crushed. I really don't, because I'm not in this. This should be about the animal itself. I mean, do you care about whether or not the animal exists? And if you do care, what do you want to do to protect it? What do you want to do to make sure that this animal does not become extinct? That's why I'm in this. I don't know about anybody else, but I'm not in this for my dreams, you know, and I don't think of it that way. It's not about me.
And I'm in it pretty much for the same reason you are, Melissa. If there is a creature out there, obviously its numbers are very low, and it needs protection.
Right.
And this isn't going to, and we're not going to cue any corny music or anything.
Nope.
This is very serious. We're notorious for driving species of animals to the brink of extinction.
Yep.
And even making them go extinct. It's not a joke. It's not funny. Look at John Green, you know, in terms of dreamers. John Green has been in this for 50 years, and outside our little community, he's not famous at all. But John Green never got in this to be famous. He got in this to document the story, and because it's a huge interest of his. He's probably the most well-known researcher, aside from maybe a select few, but he didn't get in this to be famous.
And, you know, I mean, honestly, off the top of my head, I can't think of one researcher that I know that's in this because they're dreaming of what could be. I mean, for them, personally. I mean, I can't say that I know one researcher who even thinks that way. Everybody I talk to in this research is more concerned about documenting the animal and getting it protected.
And we'll take a step backward now so we're not getting a little melodramatic.
Right.
back to evidence. For a long time, I've been a big believer that we need to start applying forensic and scientific principles to the collection of evidence. So many times we've run into the issue that our evidence has been contaminated.
Yep.
You know, rather be through the collection of hair, blood samples that's supposed to be collected from the ground, even saliva, stuff like that that could prove to be very vital has been completely destroyed by mishandling. And one thing I want to point out is that on Sasquatch Legend Meets Science, one thing that bugs me during that whole documentary is the gentleman that is analyzing the hair, and he is not wearing any protective covering on his hair at all.
Esteban Sarmiento.
Him, but the gentleman at the end that's, and the DNA, taking the DNA extractions
from
the apple. Not one time did they ever, even examining the Skookum cast, did they ever wear hair protection. And that bothers me.
I agree with you.
And it's just something simple like hair that really drove me over the edge. But this documentary is clouded as being the best documentary on Sasquatch, yet simply looking at that and realizing that the, you know, so-called experts, you know, really aren't even doing a great job at evidence handling.
Well, I agree with that.
I mean, and we're all human. We're subject to mistakes and errors. But
right.
when you're doing something that's so important...
Right, but you're also talking about a group of people who at the time, they thought they had a good idea of what they might have, but they didn't have any proof of it. And at that time in this research, I don't really think a whole lot of people put a great amount of thought into how do you preserve evidence. So, I mean, it was a mistake, but you know what? We move on and we learn from those mistakes. I'll bet you if you ask Rick Noll if he'd ever do the same things again, he'd probably tell you no, just like anybody else who's made a mistake like that. But there's so many different ways that DNA evidence can be ruined before you even get there. So, but that doesn't negate the fact that researchers need to use proper protocol if they think that they are going to be encountering any kind of evidence that could contain DNA. You still need to do the proper procedures, and you need to know how to properly collect and preserve that evidence. But, you know, I ask researchers all the time if, you know, when they bring up the conversation, what do you do? And I just shake my head, and I think to myself, well, you know, this is why we get, you know, contaminated on our results or, you know, unknown or whatever.
And unfortunately, evidence collection for most of us is a work in progress.
Right.
You know, we're not, most of us don't have any, you know, specific law enforcement training to collect evidence or, you know, forensics trainings or anything of that sort. But, however, I don't think that negates us from the responsibility of learning it.
Right.
And we're all capable of learning, and I think it's very important that we, you know, make this, you know, once again, I'll refer to that a part of standard operating procedure. I think it's just a necessity that we do this. And, you know, if the independent investigators don't want to join up and, you know, agree to this, you know, this is how we're going to collect evidence, then, you know, let's see what their evidence yields for them.
Right.
You know, there's a price to pay for independence.
That's right. You know,
everybody always thinks they have the right answers. And I'm not saying our answer is the right way. I'm saying our answer is the best way. Our answer is the best way. Our answer is a step in the right direction.
Well, it's better than walking up to a potential hair sample and picking it up with your fingers. You know, I mean, come on. Either you want to be serious about this.
As Chuck Adinolfi says, CSI Sasquatch.
Right.
Exactly.
Well, and when you're handling things like this, you should be careful if you think that there's any kind of biological evidence. You need to be careful, regardless, because you don't know. I mean, if you come across a known animal, like a bear or something in the woods, there can be all kinds of contaminants on the body of that animal that you want to pick through. you need to know how to handle these types of situations for you first, and then for your evidence collection, you know, as well. So, I mean, there's all kinds of things that you need to think about, and unfortunately, the scientific, the community is not coming together on this issue, but it's starting to happen, which I think is very positive.
One thing that concerns me is, and it's just for health and safety reasons, is when people collect scat. One mistake is I've seen people actually stick their faces down almost right on top of it and inhale. They don't realize all the bacteria and the potential viruses they're getting
right.
from handling, feces.
Yeah.
It's not exactly a I'm not a big fan of collecting feces. I'm not a big fan of feces, period.
No.
But I think there's, people should be listening tonight should be very aware of the health dangers involved in collecting some evidence.
Right. Absolutely.
But I think that's going to be the challenge that maybe I'll lay out to us, Melissa, we could work on in the American Bigfoot Society with other groups and make this a big task between every group is coming up with that adopted, standardized procedure. And more hands in the pot, the better, because the more ideas I get, I think we'll be on the way to collecting some good evidence. It was Paul Vella that said, Paul Vella, the researcher, that, asked the question, should we discard all the evidence that we've collected up to this point and start new? And I don't, and sometimes I really agree with that. I think we have to start fresh. But, without learning from our mistakes, we're not going to go anywhere. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. That kind of situation.
We're getting some interesting comments in the chat room here.
Are there any fans of feces? What's all this talk about endangered feces? I'm reading them. Crap is bad. Yeah, I see. I see it all.
Crappy job.
But someone's got to do it. It's time to wade ankle deep.
Well, we got 3 minutes, bro.
Melissa, final thoughts.
I beg your pardon?
Final thoughts. You're the last piece of advice you'd like to give everybody that you're listening to.
Well, just get out there and look. If you don't know something, learn it. Learning is always a good thing. I mean, read up on the subject, talk to other researchers, spend time on the internet boards, and get to know the other researchers from across the country. And just get out there. Get evidence.
Perfect advice. Melissa, thank you very much for joining us tonight, and a very special birthday wish goes out to you from me and mine, and I hope you have just, you and Henry both have such a terrific day tomorrow. Enjoy it.
Yes, sir.
Be glad you're on this earth another day, and just when you wake up in the morning, take a nice, deep, fresh breath of air.
Yeah. And Melissa, Billy passes along a big hug to you.
Big hugs back to you, Billy.
I think tonight's been an extraordinary show. I think it's been one for the record books. I think we had a serious discussion, a serious look, but at the same time addressed some really good issues. Melissa, always a privilege to have you here with us.
Thank you, Sean. Always happy to be here.
And
you can
find more on Melissa at texassasquatch.blogspot.com or now the new Sasquatch. The search for Sasquatch form, it's
searchforbigfoot.org.
Yep, that's the site. And I have to say, though, that website is run in conjunction with my partner, Teresa Hall. Fantastic woman, great researcher out of Arkansas, and I couldn't be happier about sharing this forum with her.
That's great.
And folks, stay tuned because you never know what's going to happen on the Sasquatch Experience. I'm always very proud to have great researchers on our show. It's such a privilege for me to talk to such great people. And people that are always on the same page. This community has a big division in it, and I think this show is just one of the stepping stones to start bringing us together, because in the end, we're all after the same thing.
Yep.
And the more we work together, the sooner we'll get this solved, if we can solve it.
Yep.
Getting kind of deep tonight, folks. Getting kind of deep.
Is.
And no, we're not drinking, for the record. I'm drinking a cherry Coke. It doesn't get more virgin than that.
I'm having green tea.
She's having green tea. And Henry hasn't had anything because I haven't had her toilet flush this whole episode. So That's a record. What a great show it's been tonight, folks. Melissa, once again, thanks for joining us. James Baker, thanks for joining us again, my friend. Henry, take us home.
Y'all be good or be good at it.
Thank you, folks. You've been listening to the Sasquatch Experience. Next week, we have the Sasquatch sleuth, Larry Lund. And the following week is our open mic discussion
on Jan Clements, the creature.
Stay tuned, and I hope you all join us for those shows. Henry will be flying solo next week. Wednesday, join us 9:30 p.m. Eastern for the Sasquatch Experience Light. And just because things happen from time to time, please check out the blog, sasquatchexperience.blogspot.com. Thank you all tonight, folks. It's been a pleasure. Keep on squatching. Still there, bro? Melissa, still with us? Everybody's gone.